capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Hello and welcome to Level Talk Programme. A recent report by the World Economic Forum called the Inclusive Growth and Development Report 2017 portrays the world economy as suffering from near-zero interest rates, unfavourable demographic trends in most countries, relatively low growth, widening income inequality and the shortcomings of globalisation. Now, if that isn't depressing enough, the report also points towards wealth inequality and technology as being the main problems, and even reported this could lead to a reversal of globalization. If all this is correct, how should these problems be tackled? What national and international organizations do we have, if any, that are capable of resolving these issues? Joining me on this program to talk about these huge issues is David Soggy, an independent researcher and writer based in Amsterdam, where he's affiliated with the Transnational Institute, and Professor Mark Beeson from the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Western Australia, Perth. Welcome to the program, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Now, if I can ask you a kickoff question here. You've heard a list of all these terrible problems that the World Economic Forum has brought up. Now, in your opinions, I'd just like you to, both of you, to give your opinion, please, here. What is the main issue, if you can identify a main issue about all those issues that have been mentioned, which is behind the somewhat pitiful state of the world economy at the present time? May I ask you to start, please, David Soggy?
Two words.
Yep.
Social contract. The disintegration or the inattention to social contract in North Atlantic countries and Japan, where income inequality is also growing from a relatively low base. These are the things that concern me, and I think concern lots of others, such as Danny Roderick and others who point to this as a central problem. It's not mentioned by the World Economic Forum, but I think it should be.
Okay, thank you very much. Professor Beeson.
Well, I think it partly depends what you mean by globalization, and I think it's important to try and break it down a bit and think about what that actually means, because if you think about globalization as meaning greater economic interdependence between different parts of the world, that's not necessarily a bad thing, and I think it's interesting to think about it in the context of, say, relations between China and the United States at the moment. I think both sides of that relationship recognize that they are interdependent, and that constrains their actions in useful ways, it seems to me, for the rest of the international community, because they might otherwise behave in a unilateral manner that might not be terribly helpful for the rest of the world. So I think it's important to think about what it actually means at different levels, and clearly it's going to have different impacts on different people as a consequence of that.
Yeah, incredibly complex issues, two very, in a way, different answers, but they both have one, I think, common underlying thread. You've both mentioned globalization. You've talked about social contract, David, but I think you're talking about it within the context of globalization. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. And I see that globalizing factors, the power of large corporations, for example, is one of the factors leading to the dismantling of the social contract and thereby the creation of anxieties and a kind of a return blowback from people who are concerned about their future, the future of their children and their grandchildren.
Yeah. At the Davos Forum and a few weeks ago, the WF founder and executive chairman, Klaus Schwab, stressed the importance that globalization be paired with social responsibility. I quote, "There can be no sustainable growth without the public at large seeing themselves as a main stakeholder in the successful functioning of the economy." But from your point of view, Professor Beeson, you know, you're pointing out the good side of globalization, you know, the fact that there is some sort of at least communication between countries and trade terms, and I guess there is some sort of, you know, efforts made to equalize vastly different levels of income and so on, just because there's this trade going on. But my question would be to you, is it working or not? Because we still have huge disparities.
Oh, undoubtedly, and it was ever thus. And one thing to think about is to put this in historical context. And one of the most remarkable things that's happened over the last 20 or 30 years or so has been the rise of China, for example. Yeah. And that's profoundly changed the kind of per capita income distribution across the world in potentially good ways. Now, I think the interesting thing is that within national economies, the United States and China, income inequality and the maldistribution of wealth is clearly becoming an increasingly important problem. And that's having important political effects, not the least of which is the rise of populists like Donald Trump. Yeah. So at one level, there are big and important things happening within national economies that could be addressed by nationally based policymakers if they chose to do so. There's also things going on at the transnational level where there are still obviously important differences in terms of economic outcomes and inequality across the national borders as well. So it is a very, very complicated process, but I think we do need to keep in mind that there have been some benefits of the things that are associated with economic interdependence that we shouldn't lose sight of, I think. Yep. And it, as I say, it depends which bit of the global economy you happen to be focusing on, which bit of the regulatory framework you're paying attention to as well, I think.
Yeah, okay, I agree with you. And unfortunately, a program like this, we really can't focus in that much detail on one particular aspect of it and try to keep the discussion very generalized. But there is, you know, the angle that Danny Roderick, an American economist, points out, the trilemma theory that states it's only possible to have two of the three of globalization, democracy, and national sovereignty. I mean, I'm not an expert, but surely this is a major problem. I mean, if we do have globalization, there is the risk of losing either a democracy or national sovereignty. And this surely then leads to the populist kind of politics that we're seeing in the States and now in parts of Europe. Is this not really serious? Please, I'm just coming, somebody,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to follow Roderick's thinking on this, and it's yeah. interesting to see him come down on the side of democracy and domestic politics as central. And he's somewhat skeptical about global governance as such, as the magic key to social justice and mm-hmm. Better control over powerful economic actors. But he doesn't rule them out. He says that global governance can be helpful where it sets ground rules, where it encourages attention to facts and transparency, so that domestic interest groups can carry on public debate and realize public goals according to reasonably open democratic procedures. And I find that rather convincing. It's definitely not what's happening at the moment, whether the trend is toward the powerful interest groups having the last word on a lot of legislation.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's right. I agree with a lot of that. But I think part of the problem is that there's inadequate institutional infrastructure at the transnational level
right. That's
able to
place
curbs on the action of vested interests of one sort or another. So, and the other thing to recognize, I think, is that sovereignty itself is not necessarily the be-all and end-all. Many people get very excited about it and concerned about infringements of sovereignty, but often they're populists with fairly narrow nationally-based interests that are unlikely to advance any kind of progressive politics, particularly at the transnational scale. So I think one of the challenges, it seems to me, is this question of global governance and whether it can be made more effective.
Right.
And the kind of principles and institutions that it's associated with. But it could theoretically at least be a useful force in actually curbing some of the excesses that are committed under the name of national sovereignty and independence.
But it seems to me we're all talking about an ideal that exists within the context of populations which sincerely believe that their rights have been threatened by any infringement at all, perceived infringement on their national sovereignty. And any such perceived threat will be interpreted by populist politicians, will be used as ammunition, actually, to pursue and to further the aims of populist politicians. So it's actually incredibly dangerous. And we may be in a situation where perhaps all the benefits of globalization could be easily undone by a few very, very strong verbal politicians who are able to gather enough support behind them.
No, I think that's clearly the case. And I think we can see what's happening in the European Union at the moment, because in many ways the European Union is the best example, in its heyday at least, of that kind of transnational regulatory framework that was designed to advance a sense of collective interest that transcended national borders. And in my judgment, that wasn't a bad thing to be interested in trying to do. I think the problem is that many people have, there's technical problems with the way the EU itself has developed over time, and there's no doubt there's been some mistakes made. But I think the big lesson, it seems to me at least, from that attempt to develop collective institutions across national borders, well, it effectively pacified one of the most violent places on the face of the planet. And there hasn't been a war in Europe for the last 50 or 60 years or so as a direct...
Well, give us a chance, OK? I mean, we want to get back to be able to having wars, you know. We're really trying hard at the moment. Give war a chance, you know. But, Professor, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. I couldn't help it. But are you not also aware of the other side of it, that although we have this sort of harmony in a way, I'm using the past tense because I'm a Brit, OK? I'm sitting in the UK and I can see the end in sight, unfortunately. But we tended to forget that we are only a small part of the world. And although we may have established harmony to a certain extent, inter-European trade relations through the EU, we certainly didn't establish harmony with the rest of the world, you know, with some of the third world countries. You know, I mean, it's almost like we convinced ourselves that the way that we're treating our, you know, each other within the EU is the standard, the norm, but it isn't.
No, indeed. That's not an unreasonable point to make at all. However, the fact that any kind of transnational cooperation anywhere, some kind of collective interest that transcended national borders occurred at any time, anywhere, that's the remarkable thing, it seems to me, not the fact that it's been problematic.
May I pose a question to you, Professor Beeson, about China as a current and possibly future competitor? In the time of the Cold War, there was the model of the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc, which had a certain reasonably effective social contract working, and that was a stimulus, I think, to Western countries to keep their welfare state and their social services in order, pay for them with taxes and tax people for it. Now, in the case of China, it seems different, but I see it with no direct knowledge and so on. I wonder what your take on that would be, China as a competitive model.
Well, it's an interesting question. And I think one of the bizarre and paradoxical things about the international system at the moment is that it's actually Xi Jinping who's trying to position himself as a champion of globalization when Donald Trump is pursuing a much more kind of nationalist agenda. Now, there's obviously a big question about whether the Chinese are actually serious about this and whether they're prepared to shoulder some of the burdens that are associated with trying to provide collective leadership of that sort, and whether they actually want to do it and they're sincere about it. But that in itself is a remarkable turnaround. And I think the interesting thing about China is that they do have a different kind of model and different kinds of assumptions about the best way of managing both domestic and international economic action. Now, not all of those are going to be appealing to a Western audience, and there's going to be really big problems in pursuing those kinds of things in any kind of broad way. But the fact that there is a debate about some of the fundamental issues and principles about around which a global economy or a system of global governance could actually be developed is a really interesting kind of development, I think.
Okay. Actually, I'd like to come back to this after a short break.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Welcome back to Level Talk Program. My name's John Harrison. Today we're talking about the current world economic situation, in particular globalization. I'm talking to David Soggy, an independent researcher and writer based in Amsterdam, and Professor Mark Beeson from the Department of Political Science and International Relations, the University of Western Australia, Perth. Now, gentlemen, we just started talking about solutions to this problem, and Professor Beeson, you were talking some length, actually, about China and possible solutions there. But straight away, alarm bells go off in my uneducated economic sense mind. China is a socialist country. Well, it calls itself communist.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. I mean, it advocates state control of the economy. Now, of course, they have options available to them, but we don't, do we, in the West? We don't have those sort of options because we don't believe in that. We believe in privatization now. We believe in the opposite, in fact. Surely there is a paradox here. If you're saying, Professor Beeson, that perhaps solutions to, you know, the problems of globalization could be found in more left-wing policies, then that does not go against the very core of the essence of the direction of which the West is going.
Well, I'm not sure I characterize China as left-wing, actually, but despite the label.
But there is a single state capitalism, surely. State capitalism. I mean, a lot of these Chinese interests.
It's a capitalist economy.
State
but
capitalist.
It's a fairly authoritarian one.
Yeah.
And the kinds of options and policy positions that are available to China wouldn't be acceptable or wouldn't be feasible, I don't think, in comparable economies in the West. But that doesn't mean to say that regulatory reform isn't possible. And I think we have to also reckon, this is why I think the national framework is really important for thinking about how globalization, in inverted commas, actually plays out in different countries. Because at the moment, it's clear that the Trump administration, despite all the rhetoric about draining the swamp and all the rest of it, is actually, they've got a bunch of Wall Street bankers in there running the place, and they're going to wind back the kinds of regulatory reforms that were put in place under the Obama administration. So, I mean, the point to emphasize, I think, is that, you know, globalization in inverted commas is basically a political construct, and it looks different in different countries because of the political forces that are able to shape it in particular ways. So I think the challenge is to try to think about ways of developing political structures that are able to shape and regulate globalization in progressive ways across national borders. And that's the big challenge. And the track record is not good. And I think that's why the EU stands as a sort of very lonely example of what can be done under reasonable circumstances.
Okay, David.
I'm glad Professor Beeson brought up the issue of banking and the banking financial sector. It's one of the sectors that is carefully skirted in documents such as the one you opened the program with from the World Economic Forum. They note the problems of global governance, but give a kind of free pass to the banking sector in their new model of multi-stakeholder governance, in which governments, civil society representatives, selected ones, and the business sectors sit around the table and govern the world. The banking sector is the one sector in which that model is, for the World Economic Forum, not desirable, and that's given a special category. And yet, it's precisely through the banking sector that I think many governments, and not just in the West, but in the countries that I know in Africa, are facing continual, almost structural fiscal problems. They just don't have the money to pay for, well, a social contract, whether one could hope for that. Mm-hmm. And I think there, if we are to look at ways forward, we can look at work done by the activists on tax justice, who are looking at how money escapes public control, public supervision, through tax havens. And I think the Tax Justice Network is one example of an organization, a worldwide network, a global network that's doing good work and deserves more time and attention.
Would that mean that individual governments have to give it more time and attention, have to take their recommendations seriously, have to introduce legislation? But what chance is there of that happening?
Well, I think pessimism is in order here. Yes.
I mean, I apologize if I'm pessimistic.
5 years ago, the OECD and the IMF and all of the other major institutions on the planet scarcely talked about illicit financial flows or tax evasion, tax avoidance, and so on. Now, it's pretty high on agendas. As someone said, there are today on the front pages of newspapers two words, not just one, three-letter words that end with the letter X, and one of them is tax.
Okay.
I'll let you guess the other one.
Let's not dwell on that one. Let's move on.
Okay. So in that respect, I see forward motion on the tax front.
Okay, very good. And Professor Beeson, please, if you have any other, you know, your own personal theorist, perhaps, as the way, if you were in a position of authority to, you know, direct, to influence governments, the world economy as a whole, what would you suggest, you know, to alleviate potential problems, the situation that we're in now, as far as inequality in particular goes?
Well, I think having some greater level of international cooperation that's supervised by some kind of effective regulatory body. I know this is terribly out of fashion, and people speak disparagingly of institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, and possibly for very good reasons, given their track record at different moments in history.
Right.
But I think the reality is, to take the example of global tax dodging and tax minimization by powerful multinational corporations. The only way that anybody's ever going to be able to do anything about this in an effective form is through much greater levels of international cooperation and coordination to make sure that tax havens aren't able to flourish outside of that kind of regulatory framework. So it requires more cooperation rather than less, in my view, to be able to address this. But before that can happen, of course, you need consciousness raising of the sort that David was talking about and getting this on the agenda in the first place. And then you need political pressure on policymakers around the world to actually do something about it. And it should be something they ought to take seriously, because the great payoff for national governments everywhere, of course, is they're going to raise more tax revenue. And that's the biggest way of actually addressing many of the kind of concerns we've been talking about of global inequality. Because if you've got some extra money that you're raising, extra revenue, then you've got something you can redistribute. And unless you do that first, mm-hmm. then the other kind of questions are somewhat academic, I think.
Yeah, good point.
Mm-hmm. Would you agree then, Professor Basin, would you take on board David's point here about tax havens as being another, particularly with the banks, that is another major issue, should be put on board the responsibility of these international organisations?
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, something that should be addressed very, very seriously, because they don't really do much good for the global economy, or certainly not for ordinary people mm-hmm. by any stretch of the imagination. So they're parasitic, essentially, and produce nothing of any terribly useful form. So I think there's a very strong argument for saying that they should be monitored, controlled, and sanctions should be applied on them if necessary to discourage that kind of behavior. But as I say, it requires a really systematic effort by some of the most powerful economies in the world, and the need to recognize that they do have important interests in common in trying to do something about this. So I don't think it's beyond, there's some technical issues and difficulties about this, no doubt, but I don't think it's beyond the realm of possibility if there's sufficient political will to do something about it in the first place.
In by way of asking you your gut feelings, please, do you think that the world has enough sort of will, basically, to strengthen these international organizations that we've been talking about? Or are we just so gung-ho now on this sort of basically self-destructive process of increasing polarization in society, increasing privatization, increasing fragmentation for the interests of smaller groups of people? I guess the question is humanity's will to survive strong enough or not? Start with David.
Sorry
about that. A big question, but it's what listeners want to know, because we get an awful lot of information, a lot of statistics, but what we'd like to know is it going to be all right or not,
Well, the Nietzschean will to power I'm afraid of is the nihilistic side that's crawling out from under rocks in various parts of the world, but especially in the United States, where the main agenda item is actually deconstruction, if not destruction, of the public sector. And therefore, things like taxes, we don't need taxes except to pay for our military, which is the one exception that is made. And in that respect, I am concerned. And watching people like Trump and his counselors go about their work in dismantling regulations and dismantling whole institutions is very worrisome. So if that's an expression of popular will or political will, then I think we have a lot to be worried about.
Professor Beeson, tell us some good news, please.
I think potentially the good news is paradoxically about climate, because in my view, that's still the biggest collective problem that we all face. And I think most people, Donald Trump may be an unfortunate exception, have recognized that that we do have a collective problem that is really fundamental. And the only way of addressing this is through some sort of unimaginably extensive transnational cooperation of a sort that we haven't really seen much of. And there are grounds for immense skepticism about the prospects there. But I think gradually, unfortunately, the evidence about those kinds of things will become so overwhelming that some kind of cooperative effort will have to be undertaken at some stage. And I guess the big question is whether it will be too little too late by the time they actually get around to doing it. But I think that is potentially something that does really raise the consciousness about the global situation that we actually inhabit, because we are all citizens of the same planet ultimately. So our fates unambiguously bound up together, and it's just a question of getting policymakers to recognize that that's a reality, I think.
Okay, let me say something terrible here. Do you think that it's going to take a major global crisis, environmental crisis, bring us to our senses? Because, quite honestly, I've been covering the environment, Voice of Russia, before the present radio station or Sputnik 5 years. You know, the things we talked about are vast. And imagine, nothing's really changing. It's getting worse. My opinion, it may be different. You know, sitting there in Australia, you may have a different perspective on things. But in Europe, you know, we're in the process of deconstruction, not just of, you know, state institutions. We're in the process of deconstruction of our environmental programs right now, at least in the UK.
Mm.
You know, and this is serious stuff, and we know what's going on in America. Are we perhaps so stupid that we need to sort of be taught a lesson before we're going to learn anything?
Well, if you're asking me, I think there is a process of two steps forward and one step back. And I think some people, I think, are willing and highly conscious of the kinds of collective problems we face. But I think it comes back to the sorts of things we were talking about earlier on at the national level. And at the transnational level, for that matter, there are still very powerful vested economic interests
right.
who are willing to wring every bit of profitability they can out of particular resources, no matter what the long-term damage may be to the overall environment. And I think making that distinction between private individual interests and some kind of collective interest is one of the great challenges of trying to make globalization something other than a kind of metaphor for economic gain and something that's to do with the planet and the way that we live as human beings.
Yeah. David, final words?
Yeah, I just chime in with Professor Beeson's remarks and note of optimism. There are advances already, some of them 20, 25 years old, on the Montreal Protocol, on CFCs, protection of hardwoods, protection of fish, reducing small arms, taking care that hazardous wastes are properly looked after. Those are all accomplishments at the global level through combination of the policymakers that Professor Beeson is talking about and social movements
yep.
that have just kept on the job. And I hope listeners out there will think about where they can themselves take part in that work.
Thank you very much indeed. David Sogge, an independent researcher writer based in Amsterdam. Professor Mark Beeson from the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Western Australia, Perth, for participating, I think, fascinating conversation that started off and ended with the environment. And I think that's absolutely correct. Goodbye. Tune in again next week.